Welcome to episode 6 of season 3 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Rich DiGregorio.
And I am film watcher Greg Rowell.
So this episode, we're getting into the world of food.
Foodie's paradise, yes.
Yeah, with films which have a lot of food in them, or have themes of food.
Very focused around food and the things that happen around food, which is usually cooking and eating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the first film we're going to be looking at this episode is a film called Big Night, which is a 1996 film.
Yes. And then we're going to talk about The Vet's Feast from 1987.
And then we're going to be looking at the 1992 film Like Water for Chocolate.
And those last two films are quite possibly films that you've heard of before. Mm. But Big Night is probably less well known, but certainly fits into this theme. So on that note, Ricardo, why don't you tell us about, Big Night.
Okay, Big Night. Meet Italian chef Primo, Tony Shalhoub, and his business partner and brother, Secondo, Stanley Tucci. Both are immigrants from Italy who opened their dream restaurant, Paradise, in New Jersey. Primo's authentic Italian food does not suit many local tastes, not having spaghetti with meatballs on the menu being one of them, and the restaurant is struggling. So much so that the bank will close the place should their business not start generating money. When Pascal, Ian Holm, the owner of the popular Italian restaurant across the road, tries to help the brothers do better, he invites famous Italian-American bandleader Louis Prima to appear at the Paradise, and the two brothers put all their efforts into a big night, which will most likely decide whether or not the restaurant will close or stay open. Now throw in Minnie Driver as Secondo's love interest and Allison Janney as Primo's love interest, and we have a mild, slow-paced comedy. The food in the film, though, does make your mouth water. Directed with no real flair by actors Stanley Tucci and Campbell Scott, this 1996 film never really hits the mark. Greg?
Okay, so you've already just about given your score on that.
Not really given my score. You don't know exactly what I'm going to give. But no. I don't think this film really hits the mark.
Well, this is going to be another of those films where I get really intimidated by your Italian.
Yeah, okay.
But I'm going to have to say, you should at least have said, New Jersey rather than New Jersey.
New Jersey.
Yeah, you do it better anyway. look, this is obviously an actor's film.
Yeah.
And it was written by Stanley Tucci, who plays Secondo.
That's right.
Secondo, is that okay?
Secondo.
He wrote the film, apparently, to get a good part. He was in a film that he wasn't enjoying making, and he wrote this to have a good part to play. It's very much like Good Will Hunting,
Matt
Damon and Ben Affleck.
That was much better.
Yes, it was, actually. Yeah. Sorry. And it's directed by two actors, and you've mentioned a few, but it's stuffed full of, really good actors who are giving very good performances. Yeah. But the story, and Ian Holm, in some ways, because he's a British actor, was almost too Italian.
Yeah, he was over the top. He was playing it way too much.
Yes. It's a lot of actors who are obviously enjoying being in this together.
Yeah.
You haven't mentioned Isabella Rossellini.
Yeah, you're right. Yes, I haven't actually. No, she was in there as well. Yeah, as Ian Holmes,
mistress.
Oh, mistress. Yeah.
But I particularly like the part where Pascal is giving the pep talk to Secondo in his office, and he says, "Look at these photos." But obviously, in an over-the-top Italian way. Look at these photos on my wall. So Louis Prima, before that, Humphrey Bogart. How he met Humphrey Bogart.
Yeah.
Bogart came to the restaurant, and they finish that scene. And next thing, they're at the front of the restaurant with the daughter of Ingrid Bergman, who famously was in Casablanca of Humphrey Bogart. It's packed with actors and almost legacy of Hollywood in this, and that's its strength. But the story is weak.
There are moments in this, okay. There are moments which are great, which are funny. But the thing is, what I think is a real problem in it is the editing.
Yes.
They really try. It's overlong, okay. And I know they play a lot. And I can see what they're trying to do. They play these scenes out in uncomfortable sort of silences to try and sort of bring a realism to the piece, but it just drags it out.
The final scene.
The final scene is 5.5 minutes.
Was it? Oh.
It's 5.5 minutes over nothing of someone cooking an egg, having Mark Anthony, Mark Anthony's a good actor. He's also a singer.
Yes.
Okay. What is he doing in this film?
Almost nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah.
There is no, I thought Mark Anthony's in this. He's a singer. I know he can sing. I thought with the Louis Prima,
Italian songs,
I thought he would probably get up and He's going to do something. He's going to sing a song, and he's going to arouse everybody's interest. But this is
1996. Was he well known for that back then?
Not really, but the thing is, he could. But in terms of look at screenplay, what is he doing there? That character has absolutely no purpose.
Well, his only purpose whatsoever. Is to put a jacket around Mini Driver on the beach.
That's not enough.
Yeah, I agree.
So things like that were frustrating because I thought he was going somewhere with this character. I thought they were going somewhere with this character, but he went nowhere. And the thing is, on that last final 5.5 minutes, what was the editor thinking? Seriously, that moment, that 5.5 minutes, and I understand what it is. It's showing the brotherly connection, which comes through very well.
And some reconciliation, yeah.
And that's great. When they just touch each other at the end and they give each other a hug with one arm, they can understand each other.
Yeah. It's a nice image.
It's a nice image, which should be 45 seconds to a minute at max, and I would have got it perfectly. But to have him cooking an egg, having Mark Anthony sitting there for like 2 minutes, then going off and doing nothing.
He got the bread.
No, but he goes there, nothing. He walks off.
Yeah.
So what's the point? And then suddenly the brother comes in and then they put their arms out. That's it, 5.5 minutes on a wide shot. There's not even a cut. It's a wide.
So say what you really mean.
My goodness, it just frustrated me. I thought, what are you doing, editor?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you pick up on the editing part of it.
Oh.
Because I sat down to watch this with my wife and I thought, oh, she'll enjoy this. But she gave up very early on. The first time that they go into Pascal's restaurant and the camera's kind of moving around in the red light and it's very kind of woozy.
Yes.
She said, I can't watch this. And she went to bed. She just, that one scene turned off the whole film. Well, and I get that.
I felt that bit was a bit odd in terms of the way they directed it. I thought, what are you trying to show here? Are you trying to just... I didn't sort of understand the camera movements they were using. I didn't understand why they were using those. It just felt a little bit odd and off. Maybe because it is Pascal's place, I don't know, but it just felt a bit odd with the extreme close-ups and the odd angles of the car, and I didn't really understand
that. I did like it when they went to Pascal's office, and he's telling Secondo, you know, you need to do this, and I'll help you with that, and all the time that desk lamp is hiding his mouth.
I love that.
That was really clever.
I really love that. That was clever.
Until he suddenly pops it down.
Yeah.
But you can't see his face, and it's a bit heavy-handed in some ways, because as the film progresses, you realise that Pascal is not the helpful person he's purporting to be. And that was a bit of a flag, but I didn't mind that. It got more heavy-handed later on. But it was a nice way of saying, you cannot see what this guy is really saying.
Yeah, I like that too. Like I said, there was clever moments, and there were
there's a lot of clumsiness too.
Oh,
so the scene on the beach, did you notice the shadows?
No.
So when the brothers are resting on the beach towards the end, and in fact I went back 2 or 3 times, I thought, have I not seen this right? And they're both wearing white on this beach, so the shadows are really obvious. And as they're wrestling, a different shadow goes across them. It's obviously the film crew. And it hasn't been picked up on. Alison Janney was wearing different pairs of shoes across the evening.
Oh, right.
So when she... And I kind of picked up on this. I thought, something's wrong here. And I went and read a bit, as I do from time to time. So when she first comes in, and she's in a really lovely... A lot of the women's clothes are very, very lovely.
They are lovely.
She's wearing a very simple black dress with a pink shawl. It's stunning, you know. Oh, look, and suits her height.
I love Minnie Driver as well.
Yeah, I think
she's lovely in
she
it.
She is.
Yeah, and so is Alison Janney. But I love Minnie Driver. I think she's got a really lovely quality on film.
We're going to come back to this. I want to tell you about this blue part.
Go for it. Yeah.
So she comes in, she's wearing these black kind of stilettos. Other times she's wearing white flats like ballet shoes, and I wonder if she sometimes mixes shoes because she's so tall. But there's a lot of continuity errors like that in the film. The first time you go from the outside of the restaurant into the interior of the restaurant, to me it was so obvious we're going from an external shot into a film set.
Yeah, right.
It didn't feel right. There's a lot of things there that just don't work. But I'd forgive a lot about that. But I had one big problem with this film that I suspect you might not have done, and it's linguistic. At very key moments in the film, characters talk to each other in Italian. Now, you speak Italian. I'm sure you knew what they were saying. I had no idea. And I started listening when it happened. And it was when the brothers are negotiating the back garden, when the vegetable guy's there.
Yes.
And Secondo takes Primo aside and convinces him. No idea what's going on there.
You're not meant to. I didn't understand.
But some people do. Yeah. See, you do. When he's in bed with the Isabella Rossellini character, when he gets a phone call from the barber's shop.
There was no subtitles.
Not at all. And I had the subtitles actually turned on for the English parts of it. There was nothing. All it said, brackets, speaking in Italian.
Yeah.
When there's a debrief at the end of the night about how it went, when you finally find out what Pascal's up to, twice, Everyone's talking in Italian. Now, I'm sorry, there are key moments in the drama. I can half guess what's going on, but I really have no idea of the nuances of it. And yet people who speak Italian get to access that. And so I sat there feeling distance from the story and wondering, well, who is this film really for? Because what you're doing, intentionally or not, is you're actually setting up a divided audience. Some people who understand what's going on and sees the progression, and some who don't. So when the brothers have a big falling out, A, I've missed part of the stuff going along to get to that point, and B, I don't actually know what they're arguing about until they switch to English occasionally, and I just actually thought that was really poorly done.
Look, I think the film starts very slowly. I think it gets better as it progresses. I think once it hits the party or the big night, it moves faster. But then again, the big night does still go on for a little while again.
And I know exactly where the story's going.
Everybody knows where it's going.
You know what's going to happen with Minnie, Driver's character, Phyllis. You know what's going to happen in terms of Louis Prima.
As soon as he starts seeing Isabella Rossellini, you know that that's happened.
Yeah.
You know that she's going to find out. You know that Louis Prima may not show up. You know, it's all going to pretty much go to hell.
Yeah.
And you know that Ian Holmes probably had something to do with it. I just felt like I knew what was going to happen.
Exactly.
And then to end on that shot for 5.5 minutes, it just did it for me. I just went, no.
I like the fact that when they're playing that game towards the end of the big night where someone's in the middle and they've got the piece of string with the ring hidden on it.
I love that.
But the first person who gets caught cheating is Pascal.
Mm.
So, like the lamp, there are nice moments in it.
There are. And the food. Let's talk about the food in the film.
Well, that is our theme after all.
Okay. In terms of that, they got that right. Oh, my mouth was watering. I really couldn't wait to have a good bowl of pasta or something.
Was this the first of the three you watched?
Yes.
Okay, it was the last for me.
Okay,
yep.
Well, when they made that that pasta bake of the outside.
Timpano.
Oh, my goodness me, with all that mixture of the Italian, with the egg and all that.
The rest I didn't care about, but that one I watched and thought, I wouldn't mind trying that.
I'd love to. It looked beautiful. Now, all the other stuff was like, So in terms of that, they got that completely right. I just, you know, all that is authentic Italian food. I just couldn't wait to have it. I just wanted to eat it.
You know, one thing I noticed about all three of these films, one was that, you know, there's a lot of attention to the making of the food.
That's right.
As well as the consuming of it.
Yes.
And you almost expect that, but they all do it, you know, in a really nice way.
Mm.
But the other thing that really struck me is that all three of these films, they have a priest or a minister in the story.
Yeah, they do.
So the big night, and he's a very minor character. There's a priest there who's involved in a couple of conversations and enjoys it. In Like Water for Chocolate, which we're going to talk about, obviously, there's the priest who sometimes is not very priestly. And in Babette's Feast, you've got the minister has died by the time of the present of the story.
That's
it features
right.
in the past parts. But his influence is still very much there. And it's almost like, and it'd be interesting to go and look at other films that might be called foodie films, like Chocolat, for example. It's like almost that there has to be a priest in the story who either is in opposition to the sensuality of the food and the things around it, or is almost sucked into that other way. It's an interesting feature of these films.
It is, actually.
So what are you going to give it?
I'm giving this a 5 out of 10. What it needed was an editor to say, you know what, guys? This is what needs to happen. I know you love these bits because the actors are involved. I know you like these bits and what you do in these bits, but it's not working. It's slowing the pace of the film down. I think if it had been chopped and sliced up a bit more.
And made a bit more subtle in where the story was going.
I feel like...
Because I'm the same. I'm 5 out of 10.
So, all right. You are?
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go.
I thought you were going to like it more because of the Italian part.
No. Because the thing is, I thought I would too. And I saw
the
trailer. Not
just the culture, but understanding what they were saying.
Yeah, okay. But look, I liked that part of it. But I felt like as a film, it was just too clunky. And I thought the actors were doing a good job, and I think Stanley Tucci did a good job. I think Tony Shalhoub did a good job as well. It's not about the performances. It's about the pacing, and I think it really needed a chop, and I didn't think the editor did a great job. And that's where things, the editors are very important in the filmmaking process. Everybody's important, but an editor should have the clout to say, well, this needs to go, guys. I know you love the bit. I know you probably really love this bit, but we need to chop it because the pacing is way off.
Well, in fact, you and I have spoken about this before in terms of, for example, Kenneth Branagh's Labour's Lost.
Yeah.
That when you've got someone who is the director and or the screenwriter and or the lead actor, the risk is, and if they do it well, like Much Ado About Nothing, then it really, really works. But sometimes you do need someone who is the producer or maybe the editor or someone who comes in and says,
to pull it back, to make
step back and look at this. It's not what you think it is.
That's right. It's true. So the next film we'll be discussing is the 1987 film Babette's Feast. Greg, go take it away.
Discussing or salivating over?
Well,
anyway,
go for it.
I'll go for it. So this 1987 film is based on a short story by Karen Blixen, or Isaac Dinesen of Out of Africa fame. It was the career pinnacle of then 70-year-old director and screenwriter Gabriel Axel, becoming the first Danish entry to win an Oscar for the best foreign language film, closely followed by Pelé the Conqueror the following year. It tells the story of two sisters, Philippa and Martine, in a small 19th century religious community, located in the remote and austere Danish peninsula of Jutland. They're doing their best to hold together the community founded by their father, a religious minister of some note. But it's not going well, as the ageing members have fallen into worry about long past sins and bickering about real or imagined feuds. The sisters arguably know how to nourish the soul, quoting their father's lessons and leading communal hymn singing. But they don't understand the value of nourishing the human body. Much of the early parts of the film tell the sisters' backstory. We learn that Philippa and Martine each had a suitor when they were young, but that both were rejected by the sisters' devotion to their father's mission. More mysterious is their French housekeeper cook, Babette, played by French actress Stéphane Audran. We're told almost nothing of her background before arriving 14 years ago as a refugee from a Paris in revolt, although we gradually learn more in the latter parts of the film. Babette slowly improves the sisters' lives with her quiet worldliness, through her cooking and charming of the local grocer and fisherman. The ageing community members also give thanks to God for sending someone who provides edible food. When Babette wins the French lottery, she asks the sisters if she can prepare a real French meal to celebrate their father's centenary. The sisters agree, but then become anxious as the meal's scale and exoticism become apparent. They fear that this sensuous luxury is the work of the devil, designed to undermine their piety. The film becomes more comic as the community agree to eat the meal, but not to enjoy it. But this determination is gradually undermined by the wine, the meal's quality, and the educated appreciation of one of the suitors, now a general at the Queen's Court. Overall, the film is a testament to selfless devotion and artistry. Initially, this devotion is demonstrated by the sisters as they minister to their father's flock. But our attention is gradually drawn to Babette's quiet and deep gratitude, ultimately expressed by the feast that she creates for her community as a loving expression of her art. Ricardo, what did you think? Did you get hungry? Oh, no. Ricardo, wake up.
Oh, my goodness me. I was so bored by Babette's Feast. I was really looking forward to this because I knew it won Best Foreign Language Film at the Academy Awards and everything like that. And I'd heard some good things about it. And I love a nice, slow-moving film. But this here was just bored me to tears.
Ah.
Now, I get the sentiment, okay? I get that, you know, food is not just about, you know, feeding the body. It's about feeding memory and the spirit. You know, I get it. I got what they were saying. And the ending I quite liked when they were talking about the artistry and her artistry of whatever cooking. And I got that. And that was a really lovely ending. But, geez, it took a long time to get to that part. The cinematography is beautiful.
Yes.
It's beautifully shot. It's beautifully acted. It's fine. The pacing of this is, and the character, some of the characters, I did not care. I did not care. Well, who cares? Oh, I had this moment when I was younger. And some of the screenplay writing of it was just, you know, oh, are you doing that? Yes, I'm doing that. It was a struggle to get through this film. But when they actually got to Babette's Feast, it picked up and it was better when they were trying the food. And the food, she was preparing was very interesting. Mm. I liked seeing her pick up the quails and
well, prep I'd say time. In this film and like Water for Chocolate, the quails don't fare very well.
They don't. They don't.
And I suspect that both these films, you know, the credits are not in English, but I suspect there's no statement about no animals were harmed in the making of this film.
I doubt it.
The quails, the turtle,
yes.
The pig's head.
Yeah, that's right. But that was fine. But otherwise... It just had me, yeah.
You know, you don't get many foodies films about vegetarian meals, do you?
No.
There are animals that basically get it to create it, whether it's pigeon pie or whatever.
Quick, you know, did you find this boring at all?
No.
No?
No. I think this is an audio podcast, so people wouldn't have seen in the last few minutes me trying to get a word in about but. I think this film is something that you will like or you won't. Mm. And it depends partly what you look for in a film. So if you're looking for something with a stronger story, I think the story is actually relatively strong, but for some it's just not going to work. And I agree with you, most of the characters I didn't care about. Now, the people who played the older members of the religious community...
That's a problem, though. That's a problem if you don't care about the characters.
Well, no, usually I'd agree with you. Yeah, we've talked about this in our Vintage Thrillers episode recently, about The Third Man. I didn't care about the characters, and therefore I wasn't thrilled, I wasn't, you know, connected to the story. But I don't think it matters here so much because those characters, the old people, they're really like a Greek chorus and a bit of comedy thrown in, and they're kind of background. Now, they could be more developed, I agree.
Comedy?
Oh, yes. When they're doing their best to not enjoy the meal... And yet they're all, you know, mimicking what the general's doing in terms of how they eat it.
Yeah.
And they're getting into the wine. The old lady who's, you know, loving her red wine.
Subtle comedy.
Yeah, but the whole film is very subtle. I mean, the story is subtle.
It is.
So the connection about, you know, there's a few times it happens. The connections about General General Gallifred, who's the reason that Babette flees Paris... and described as escaping his blood-stained hands. But later you discover that she's supposed to have been the only person, the only woman he would have shed his blood for because she was such a great cook in Paris. Mm. The fact that the suitors who are rejected in the early parts of the film are actually the reason that the sisters in their old age are brought to a degree out of that very removed, you know, piety. So you've got Achille, the opera singer... who sends them a bit. Now, it takes 14 years for the story to reach that culmination, but he's actually the cause of that. And it's the general, you know, the old soldier suitor comes to the meal, who turns up and actually educates everyone at the table about the fact that this is something to be savoured and it is actually, you know, artistry of a particular kind.
And again, when it gets to the feast, it picks up. And I liked all that. I love the artistry. I love the sisters and the relationship with Babette.
It's certainly the highlight of the film, yes.
It is the highlight, but it takes a long time to get there.
Yeah, but I don't mind. And I think, you know, it's going to depend on who you are and what you want from this film. For some people, this film will be tedious. For other people, it will be meditative and subtle.
Oh, look, and I know that films are subjective that way. I mean, one of my favourite films is Wings of Desire, which is a Wim Wenders film. I call it visual poetry. It's a beautiful film. Other people find it completely boring and get bored after 15, 20 minutes, okay? So I understand that people, you know, but this film here, I just wanted more from it.
You didn't find this meal satisfying?
No, I didn't, but in saying that, the food did look beautiful.
It did.
Yeah, and it did look very tasty. But let's just say, on a technical level, on a filmmaker level, you can't really fault the film. The cinematography is beautiful.
Even when it's austere, it's beautiful.
It is gorgeous.
That final shot of the snuffed candle beautifully picks up the elegiac nature and the melancholy of the latter part of the film as people are reflecting on the fact that, you know, they're at the twilight years of their lives.
Mm-hmm. All that comes across really well.
Yeah.
Okay. The performances are all fine and directed well. I think the production design... and the set design as well is beautiful.
All those little huts were built for the film.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, and look amazing. They look fantastic. Mm. So technically, it's wonderful. You can't really fault it. But it's in the pacing. It's in the story. It's in me having a feel for those characters. I didn't feel anything for them, so I was struggling to care.
Well, let's place this. historically, for lack of a better word. This is 1987. And I think you and I might have talked in the past about how narrative speed has accelerated since then. And I have to say, I particularly noticed it in TV series rather than movies. Mm. But I think you could critique this film in that respect. But let's also remember that you're watching it on a TV at home in one sitting or stops and starts, whatever's going on for you. But this is one of those films I remember when I first saw it at the movies and who I saw it with, 30 years ago. But I remember how beautiful it was on the big screen, and you kind of get enveloped in the story. And when you get the beautiful scenes of all the food, you relish it. It is a foodie's
paradise.
I was trying not to use that word because it's the name of the restaurant in the first film. But it's basically actually, that's our theme, isn't it? I forgot. Foodie's paradise. And it really is. And it was visually splendid in a way that you're not going to get on a smaller screen. And look, it is slow. And this is not my favourite film, although I know it is for some people. This is the favourite film, or one of the favourite films, of Pope Francis and also a past Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. And I get why that is for them, because I think it is a meditative kind of film. It's about simple folk, and it has very universal themes about goodness and self-sacrifice and not being in a removed kind of piety from the world, but actually being of the world and relishing, appropriately, the things that the world has to offer.
It's really interesting because when I was watching it, my son, who's 7 years old, was watching it with me and he was really loving it. Now, he was trying to read the subtitles and reading as much as he could of the subtitles, which is a good training for him anyway.
Yep.
But I didn't know. I thought he might find it boring, or just like I did. And he said to me, I said, well, I find this, he said, what are you thinking of this, Dad? I said, I'm finding it quite bored. I'm actually quite bored. And he said, I'm loving it.
This is not a great film. I think it's a good film. I think, like, Water for Chocolate is a good film. I don't think Big Night is. But I think it really says some important things. It reminds us of important things. And again, I think this is why the Pope and the Archbishop probably like this film as well. It reminds you that the importance of communal activity, the importance of getting around a table together, and sometimes things can be resolved through the simple act of, sharing a meal together. That doing things to other people can be an act of love. I think there are important themes in here. I agree it's slow. I agree this film is not for everybody.
And I agree. Look, I understand the sentiment. Mm. I understand what they were trying to say. I understand all that. And they're the moments I really liked, because that they really shone through on the feast and after. But leading up to that is what my problem was. But I understand the sentiment, and I quite enjoyed that part of it as much as I could. I was aching for something to enjoy, so I did.
Do you know who I felt sorry for in the film? Was the grocer.
Yeah, right.
The grocer who's been, she's pretty much ripped him off over all these years, and the guy who brought her the news of winning the lottery, he didn't get invited to dinner. I thought at first he was the guy sitting in the corner of the kitchen. I realised that was the coach driver. Yeah. But I just thought, oh, okay, so this community is not actually everyone in the community. It's only the ones who are part of this little, church group. Did you like the opera singer, Achille?
No.
Not at all?
No.
I loved it. I just thought he was so
Beautifully.
No. I didn't like him when I first met him, but once he was in the village and he was seducing the daughter by singing, I think it was Mozart, and had such a wonderfully expressive face. Yeah. I really liked his character. No. I found that quite joyful to watch.
Didn't speak to me at all. I didn't get into the general, the young general. The older general I got into more than the younger general.
It took me a long time to realise that wasn't the same actor.
Yeah, I know. They did a good job.
They did. Whereas the opera singer, young and old, was the same actor, I think.
Yeah,
and
their
makeup there was okay. But they were so close in look.
They were.
I just thought that
But I enjoyed him as an older man than the younger man was annoying to me.
Well, I agree. And I never really quite understood why the sisters were so
rejecting their
They were very
partners.
Caught up in their father's mission.
Mm.
And I had problems with the father's character, frankly. I mean, he's a man who's saying marriage is a distraction, not a good thing. But he's already been married. He's had the two girls. He's enjoyed those pleasures of the body, but he's denying it of others. And I'm not of that world. I found his character a bit difficult.
Mm.
But overall, for you, this film?
I'm giving it a 4 out of 10.
Whoa! Mm. 4?
Yeah.
Why? And why does it get 4, not 1?
Technically.
Only technically?
Yep.
You're not interested in the story at all?
No.
Wow.
If I didn't have to watch this to talk about it on the podcast, you know how many times I tried to watch this?
Go on.
3 times. I fell asleep in the first 15 minutes every time. I had to watch it during the day, and I was going, oh, I'm going to get into this. I'm going to get, well, maybe it's because I was sleepy the other nights, but no, I didn't fall asleep, but I was struggling through it.
So, three times.
3 times.
So you were the third man.
What are you giving it, Greg?
I'm giving it a 7. I think it's an interesting choice to win the foreign language Oscar. Because I think of the 80s as being, you know, big brassy kind of films, and maybe it's a bit different, you know, for films from other places. But it is such a quiet, I think, meditative kind of film that it seems odd to me that it was picked up on by the Academy. But then again, there is a message there about, you know, the artist. And, yeah, you know, the Oscars always love stories about the artist.
Of course.
Because it's them, basically.
Yeah.
But so I don't think it's a film for everybody. I think it is a bit slow. I would have liked to have understood a bit more about the other people in the community. But I've seen it before. I enjoyed it again. I can imagine watching it again in the future, which obviously you will never do. But I think there are things in that story that I like. It's not going to be for everybody. So our third film for this episode, Ricardo, tell us about Like Water for Chocolate.
Okay. Directed by Alfonso Arau, this beautifully made 1992 film centres around Tita, Lerny Cavazos, who lives with her sisters Rosora and Gertrudis and their demanding mother, Mama Elena, Regina Torne. Tita is the youngest of the three, and as a tradition, must stay single only to take care of her mother when she becomes an old woman. Tita accepts her fate, although she's in love with Pedro, Marco Leonardi. Pedro and his father try to convince Elena, but she refuses, offering only Rosora for Pedro to marry. He takes up this offer only because he can still be close to Tita. Tita, the main cook of the house, prepares all the food to be eaten at their wedding, and when prepping the wedding cake, she cries. Then when the guests eat the cake, they feel very nostalgic about their past lives and start crying, eventually becoming sick. Tita discovers that her cooking weaves a certain kind of magic. When she's emotionally moved, her emotions flow into her cooking. Certain dishes become sort of a love song for Pedro. Now, this is a very passionate love story for Tita and Pedro, who, over time, cannot move forward in love with others due to their real love for each other. Pedro never really loves his wife, Rosaura, and Tita never fully loves the man who loves her, Dr. John Brown from America. Now, it's also a sensual and somewhat erotic film, which wears its heart on its sleeve. The film is beautifully shot by cinematographers Steven Bernstein and Emmanuel Lubezki. The performances are all lovely and really directed well by Alfonso Arau, who's also an actor himself.
He actually does one of the voices in Pixar's Coco.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Uncle Julio, I think.
Yeah, well, he's also in The Three Amigos and
Romancing
the Stone.
Yes, apparently, which I haven't actually seen, The Amigos.
Yep. Yeah, oh, well, he's a good character in there. But, look, this was a big success on release, and for good reason. I think it's a very easy watch. However, I don't think the character's journey had to end the way they did. Greg, what did you think of Like Water for Chocolate?
Well, I wouldn't describe this film as being somewhat erotic. It's quite erotic in parts.
Yes.
And it might wear its heart on its sleeve, but there's a few things it wears outside the bodices and sleeves as well. I think there's a wonderful conceit in this film, which is the idea that the cook's emotions flow into the food and then basically infect those emotions into those who eat the food. Yeah. It's a wonderful idea, and in fact, I would like to see more about it. The film really hits its heights in those scenes.
It does.
And the best of those is, in fact, the second one where she's given the roses by Pedro, and she scratches her breast with the thorns, and her blood and the rose leaves are used for rose petal sauce for quail. The poor quails again.
Yeah.
And it affects everyone, you know, with the eroticism.
That's right.
The middle daughter, Gertrudis.
Yes.
Runs out to the outhouse, strips off her clothes, is steaming, and has put cold water on, is still steaming, is steaming so much she sets fire to the outhouse.
Yeah, that's right.
Runs naked across the scrub.
And
then is picked up by the revolutionary who lifts her on her horse and they're basically having sex on the horse as they ride off into the distance. I mean, if that's not a memorable scene, I don't know what
it is. It is a very memorable scene, that one,
And there are others that are less, you know, almost over the top. But they were where the film really came alive. And I think explains a lot of the popularity of the film. That probably that sequence in particular, but not just. I found parts of the film a bit choppy. And I discovered that there are actually two versions of the film. There's the Mexican version and there's the American version. The American version cuts some parts out. And the part in particular is that when Tita goes to Dr. Brown's house and says, I'm never going back.
Yes.
And they get engaged. And then she gets the message that her mother's not well. And next thing you know, she's gone back and her mother's dead.
That's right.
In the Mexican version of the film, which apparently is significantly longer, she actually goes home and cares for her mother in her dying days.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it is. And I wonder what else is cut out. So the film is already about an hour and three quarters long, I think.
It is an hour and three quarters.
So a longer film might have tried the patience of some people, but I wonder if, in fact, that is a better film.
The mother, Elena's...
She's horrible.
Horrible.
And not very smart. I mean, I'm talking about a different time and different political system, but, you know, if you're going to oppress your daughter, marry off the man she loves to the daughter and have them under the same roof and basically sticks it to her.
That's right.
And that's the person who's going to look after you in your dotage? I don't think that's very smart.
I don't think that's a smart idea.
I don't think she thought that through.
Oh, but the bath scene where she's trying to bath her and it's
she's always horrible to her.
She's so horrible. And you can see why she'd run away.
But, some parents are like that. In fact, only last weekend I was speaking to someone about his parents and he was talking about how close he was to his father who also died when he was quite young. But the mother, who is not from an English language country originally, he said the words he knows to speak in his mother's language are all words of command and rebuke because that's how she treated him.
Yeah.
And you and I come from very different kinds of families, I know. And so that's outside our experience. So I kind of get it, but it's pretty horrible. I mean, basically, what kind of horrible person says, I know you love him and he loves you, but he can have the other one.
Yeah, no, it's awful. What a ridiculous tradition. But then with the sister saying that the...
Rosalora.
Well,
she can't cook, she can't clean.
She can't cook, she can't clean. She's,
She can't look after her children.
She hasn't got the love of Pedro at all, you know.
But this is
quite a sad character, that Rosario.
Well, but she's also pretty horrible to her sister as well.
Oh, yeah.
She tries to make amends once or twice. There's a bit of a turf war going over there over Pedro as well. But I read an interesting commentary on the film saying that, in fact, in The Three Sisters, you've got different aspects of femaleness. You've got the one who, Rosalora, the middle sister.
Yes.
She is the one who fails at all the traditional aspects of womanhood, and yet that's what she wants to be.
Yes.
You know, and then you've got the good wife, the good lover, the good mother. You've got Gertrudis, who is the rebel. And she's a bit of a rebel to begin with.
She is, yeah.
Against her mother. But it's very quiet stuff until she gets inflamed with that passionate roast dish.
Yes.
And then she literally becomes a rebel.
Well, she does.
She becomes a prostitute first and then a rebel.
And then a rebel and then a general. She's a general.
So she, you know, in the kind of the Madonna whore dichotomy, she's down the whore end. You know, she's not that traditional womanly, wifely kind of character. And then you've got Tita, who starts off as more or less the obedient daughter. She doesn't like it, but she conforms.
And rebels.
Over time, she slowly rebels to the point where she totally rejects the mother and totally rejects the mother's ghost. I have to say, I found the mother's ghost scenes quite spooky.
Oh, they were spooky, actually.
It was very well done.
Yeah,
very simply done.
With the dog barking. So you believe that the dog was seeing the spirit. And when...
And the storms.
And the storms. And also when the crack in the window.
Oh, yes.
Very well done. Very well done. And then...
Which is then undone.
Undone. That's right. That was very good. And the mother was very good.
This film stands in stark contrast to Babette's Feast. Because Babette's Feast is a very austere film.
Mm-hmm.
It's one which is about denial of sensuality. And this is, let's grab sensuality and just run with it. In Gertrude's case... Literally run with it. Even some of the visual storytelling, the scene when she's taken off to Dr. Brown's house with the quilt she's been knitting in her room and it never stops. It just goes on. I kept waiting for the end of it and you never get to see the end of the quilt.
You never do.
So there's some nice storytelling going on here too.
Dr. Brown character did frustrate me a little bit. You know, I think he's meant to.
He won an award for that role, actually, the actor.
Did he?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's meant to be annoying. I don't think you're meant to really think that he's right for her.
I feel a bit sorry for him.
You do. And it was quite a funny scene with the mother. The aunt who's deaf. He's a sad character because when it gets to sort of the end of the film, you see them a bit older.
And you think at first he's married to her.
Yes.
Yeah. Again, I suspect there was a bit chopped out of the film there because wasn't quite clear what had happened.
Actually, I'm still unclear as to what that ending has, what has happened at that ending with the characters.
Leading into the wedding scene?
Yeah.
Well, here's what I think happened. Tito was so upset at Rosa Laura's intention for her daughter, Esperanza.
That's right.
Which is Spanish for hope.
Yes.
That she was going to be condemned to the same thing that Tito had experienced from her mother, being the one who would look after her mother in old age.
And I understood
and was so
that.
Determined that yeah. that wouldn't happen. She stayed in that household to protect Esperanza and therefore said to Dr. Brown, sorry, not going to happen. But it was very jumped.
There were other
bits that didn't quite make sense. You know the woman who told Tito at one stage, I can tell you're pregnant by looking in your eyes.
Yes.
And then later, and so she was being a bit sympathetic.
Yeah.
And then later there's a scene at the wedding where she says, tell me how you make this particular dish. And she says, with love, which you can't do. I suspect there's a whole chunk of that story that's been cut out of there as well.
I think so too. I think there's more than material. I think there has been stuff cut out. John Brown gave an ultimatum, said pretty much, I'll support you.
Yeah, and if you love him, that's okay.
It's fine, but just let me know because I want to spend the rest of my life with you. Just let me know whether it's a yes or a no.
Yeah.
We don't really get that. Yeah. I don't know whether it's just meant to be up in the air, but then you see them a bit old and you see, I'm sitting there going, who's, now the kids are there, so he looked after Esperanza.
And the end of the film's a bit weird. That actually quite saying what happens.
I can't sort of say what happens because I want to.
That kind of mystical scene right towards the end.
Yeah.
And then the final scene where the narrator, who's Esperanza's daughter.
Yes.
And again, I don't want to spoil it, but there's that thing that really kind of catches you out about what's also in the kitchen with her.
Yes.
And yet that didn't quite make sense because...
It didn't.
I don't know how to talk about it without saying, but it just didn't quite gel. And again, it's a bit like... Do you remember when we spoke about...
who was in the room?
Yes. Yeah, I can't really talk about it.
But it's odd, and you'd get it as well because I felt the same way.
But do you remember when we talked about Cinema Paradiso and there were the two versions of the film? There was the version that everyone saw, which had quite a bit cut out of it.
That's right.
And then there was the director's version that had more of the story, which I wish I'd never seen.
Yeah, which I disagree with.
Yeah. This for me is the flip side. I think we've seen a version that's been a bit butchered, frankly, which became very popular. It became popular because, again, it's about food, and foodie films generally go well. It's got the wonderful scenes like Gertrudis and so on.
Yes.
It's got a bit of nudity and eroticism. Yes, never goes astray, you know.
Yeah.
And it's male and female. It's a bit even-handed, which is, you know...
It is.
Kind of nice.
Yeah, that's right.
So something for everybody, basically. But the story, particularly the second time around, because you've seen it before too, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, I have.
Second time around, they're just things that didn't quite work.
It's the
end. And the light bulb goes off when you know that they've cut bits out.
I mean, I must say, the last time I saw this film was about in 1996 or something like that.
I saw it when it came out.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. So I'd forgotten a lot of it.
And very different. And we weren't as, I don't think back then we're as used to the concept of, you know, magic realism, the idea of the magic in the everyday being very interwoven, particularly in Latin American kind of stories and films. So it was more novel for us then as well.
Yeah, I still think this is so
a lot of charm and visual storytelling carried it.
Yeah, I still
and novelty.
Think this can sit on its own.
Yeah, but I want to see the other version.
Well, so do I, because I think it's a bit of a cop out at the end.
I'm curious to know how the book ends. So the book is structured as, I think it's 12 chapters.
Mm.
Each chapter has a recipe in it, which would be interesting in its own right.
It's a very passionate
from Tita's cookbook.
Very passionate ending.
And then it has parts of the story going back. So I'm curious to know if the film and the book end the same way.
So am
I,
actually.
But again, I feel like something was cut. So you get this quote very early on in the film about halfway through, actually, about, you know, too much passion at once is not necessarily a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in the current version of the film that you and I have seen, it feels like that's a bit heavy-handed, like it's there to make sense of the end, but I suspect there's probably a more subtle story going on that we just don't get to see in this version.
I think all of the choppiness happens toward the end.
Yeah.
And so that's where I think it falls over a little bit.
From about the time that she hides up in the dovecot, it feels like that's where things start to shift.
Yeah, because then suddenly I thought you were going to be in a mental asylum, but...
Yeah.
I didn't think she was going to go that far
on the mother's death and what happens around that was all a bit sudden. And, I think someone's had a go at it
For the American audience, or to cut it down to below a certain time frame.
I also understand that this story is a bit of a fable. So
Absolutely.
But not just as a fairy tale way. It's an allegory for what was happening in Mexican society back then. So you had the whole point of the revolution, from the little of it I understand, was that there was a small group of elite who controlled the power, and everyone else didn't have access to resources or decision-making about their lives.
Mm.
That's exactly what's going on with the mother and the daughters in the film. And so, again, I think there's a very interesting story there, but I wonder if part of that progression has been chopped.
Mm. What I loved about the cinematography in this was the colour tones, that sepia-ish sort of warm oranges of the whole
film. So it feels like the past.
It feels like the past, but also you feel the heat. When they've got ice, when the Pedro's got ice and he's putting it all over his neck.
Oh, when they're all sleeping outside.
And they're all sleeping outside. Yes. You feel the heat. And that lends itself to, obviously, the eroticism as well.
Yes.
There as well.
Even the rich red of the watermelon in that scene.
Yeah, when they're just bashing the watermelon.
It's
just
luscious.
It is. And so that's all part of it. And that's good cinematography, good lighting and good direction. As well.
Now, actually, before we get to the scores, there's one more thing I want to point out. There is a connection between this film and Cinema Paradiso.
What's that connection?
Marco Leonardi, who plays Pedro, is actually the teenage Toto in Cinema Paradiso.
You know what? Oh, my goodness. Yeah, thanks for saying that, because I was looking at him all the way through it. I hadn't looked at IMDb or anything, but I was going, where have I seen him? And I know I've seen him in a foreign film somewhere, and that's exactly where it was.
But yeah. I also think we need to claim him, because although he's lived most of his life in Europe and America, he was born in Melbourne.
So
he's a Melbourne boy. I think his family moved back to Rome when he was three, but he was born in our town. He's our guy. And he's in two really quite good films, particularly Paradiso. Oh. He's an Aussie boy, yeah.
He's an Aussie boy. Wow. A Melbourne boy.
So you as an Aussie Melbourne boy.
Yeah.
Where are you going to rate this film?
I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10.
Snap.
Anybody who watches it, you'll get the sense of it's foodie
and
paradise.
It's joy.
It's one to watch. It really is.
I think of the three films, Babette's Feast is the best of the three in showing the creation of the food and the love and the artistry. It's not so focused on it in this particular film.
Well,
it's more about the effect of the cooking.
The effect of the cooking.
I think it's more of the magic. Yeah,
the magic.
It's more
of the
sensuous
cooking.
In that austere framework in Babette's Feast. I feel about this film the way I feel about Love Actually, so which we've talked about in a past season. Love Actually is a really great film. We have a few quibbles about it, but it's a great film.
Yeah.
And it was a much longer film to start with. And I would love to see the longer version of that film.
Well, I think there has been things cut out of it, and which makes it a bit awkward. I thought, have I missed something? Have I missed something in the dialogue?
The subtitles.
Have I missed something in the subtitles? Have I missed something? Because it just got confusing.
And you notice that more the second time around.
So that concludes episode 6 of season 3's Foodies Paradise podcast.
Are you feeling sated?
I'm feeling hungry.
If you knew the rubbish I'd eaten today, I had no business commenting on these films in the slightest.
I did. I had actually homemade ravioli
from Bologna,
which was very nice. Next time, we are going to actually look into and discuss some breakout performances from actors
who've gone on to become legends.
Yeah, and big stars. So we've got Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate, which came out in 1967.
Indeed. And then we're going to look at Heavenly Creatures, which particularly is noted for the early performance of Kate Winslet, but also her co-star Melanie Lynskey from 1994's film by Peter Jackson.
That's right, it is Peter Jackson.
So it's a lot of people coming to the fore
in this
film.
This was very much his breakout film as well, so we're looking at that as well. And also Kate Blanchett in Elizabeth, the 1998 film.
Our Kate.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Look, if you really love our podcast, please don't forget to rate, review us on iTunes, and also subscribe. It really helps us out.
Go and have something nice to eat.
Enjoy.